Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
The Athletic.
The Phil Hay Show.
Hello and welcome to the show. The Phil Hay Show brought to you by The Athletic and The Square Ball. I'm Dan Moylan. Hello. From The Athletic, Phil Hay.
Hello.
And from The Square Ball, Michael Normanton.
Hello.
There's a discount on at the minute if you want to get signed up to The Athletic and read what Phil's writing about. $3.99 a month. You get all these podcasts ad-free as well. What can we look forward to this week, Philip?
I mentioned this last week, but we've had an interview with Romário Vieira on the website this week, the lesser known, I think, of the two Vieira brothers, but one who was at the academy for a while, and really fascinating story, their journey from Africa to Portugal to England, but also some pretty intriguing stuff about his time at the academy and his work with Carlos Corberan, who's obviously over at Huddersfield now, but who some people have sort of spoken about as a potential successor to Bielsa further down the line. So that is well worth a look. And in the next couple of days, there will be something on the Elland Road pitch as well.
Great stuff. Head to theathletic.com/LeedsPod to take advantage of that discount. It's theathletic.com/LeedsPod to read everything that Phil's been writing about. Well, save for the cancellation of the Southampton game, we would have been about at the halfway point of the season now. We're going to have a proper half-term report in part two of this show. However, let's deal with the most recent game first. And I quite like doing this in the second half of the week, Phil, because we've all calmed down a little bit after a Leeds United defeat when it hit sort of a Thursday. We weren't great against Brighton, so what was your take on it overall?
No, it needed a few days for everybody to draw breath and just to see it a bit more soberly. There was a lot of dissatisfaction after the game, which I understood because I think it's probably somewhere up there with, you know, some of the poorest performances under Bielsa. And a really rare day where everything just seemed to go wrong, starting with the pitch, which has been deteriorating now for a good while and has been a problem for a little while as well. But to the structure of the team, particularly with the absence of Calvin Phillips and the way in which the midfield were able to link with Bamford and the wingers, the way in which the defence tried to link with Pascal Stroik, none of it particularly worked. And it was a rare day when you genuinely felt from about half an hour onwards that there wasn't going to be a goal coming. And certainly in the last 10 minutes, the point at which you thought Leeds might have turned the screw and might have just found a way to get something out of it. I think all of us in the press box were sat there really waiting for a 1-0 defeat, you know, as those minutes ticked out. And one of the things that jumped out to me afterwards when I was reviewing the game and looking through the stats was the expected goals ratio for Leeds, which was down at 0.3, which I think was in line with what we'd seen with our own eyes. You know, it didn't feel like a day when Leeds created much or looked particularly dangerous. But that is extremely low by Bielsa's standards. I was working out, you know, and looking through the XG game to game right the way through his time as head coach, which is clearly well beyond 100 games now. And there have only been 14 occasions when they've fallen below an XG of 1 over 90 minutes. And they've never been as low as 0.3 ever in his time at Leeds. So, you know, there was clearly something going on. There was clearly a day when it wasn't clicking and it wasn't happening. And it is one of those games that you really need a reset after. Put that to bed, get over it, get rid of it and move on and play better at Newcastle. But I understood the frustration afterwards because it isn't a regular thing under Bielsa performances like that.
With the XG then, that's a measure of the quality of the chances created by a side on a particular day. Why was it so low then? Is that to Brighton's credit or is it to Leeds United's detriment?
I think it is to Brighton's credit to an extent. You're right. I mean, a lot of people will know what expected goals is, but for those who don't, it's a calculation or a metric used by firms like Opta or Wyscout to analyse the quality of the chances that teams create. And the higher your XG, the more goals you should score in a game based on what you do create at the opposition's end of the pitch. So clearly, an XG of 0.3 goals over those 90 minutes against Brighton, Leeds didn't really look like scoring at any point. We talked last week about the comparison between Calvin Phillips and Pascal Stroik, and Phillips was banned at the weekend. It was a one-game ban for five yellow cards. And I did analysis of both of them before the game, and it was pretty clear from that that while they do stack up closely defensively, that there's a very big difference in the quality of the passing, or at least in the progressive nature of the passing. So the extent to which their passing lets Leeds move up the pitch and hold really strong territorial positions on the field. Phillips is extremely good at that. And when I was looking at the direction of Struyck's passing, the number of passes he completed and where he was able to complete passes to, you could see that he wasn't able to pull the strings and he wasn't able to dictate. And in part because of that, but I think also in part because of the fact that they just didn't have particularly good games. Neither Rodrigo nor Cleek were effective in front of him. Rodrigo wasn't able to get into those areas where he could really hurt Brighton. But then equally, if you compare the Brighton game to one of Rodrigo's best, which I think I'd probably pick out Aston Villa away as one of his top performances, it was a low block from Brighton and it was a very defensive lineup in the sense that there were a lot of defenders in the team. He had three very big physical centre-backs. You had Ben White in midfield who had a really, really good game, very impressive and looked like the Ben White we remembered from last season. He struggled as a midfielder from time to time under Bielsa and took a while to settle into that role when he had to deputise for Phillips, but he seemed to understand what he was doing perfectly and they essentially had the measure of Leeds and the thought in Graham Potter's head would have been get to Elland Road, score first, sit on that goal and be disciplined. And that's exactly what happened and exactly how it played out. So I think there were issues with Bielsa's own side and technical and tactical problems there. But I think you have to say as well that Brighton did get it pretty much spot on the day.
What did you make of the defensive side of Struyck's game? Because it feels like we'd lack something there as well when Phillips isn't in the team. While it's not clear to sort of point at any individual occasions, I thought, where Struyck made a mistake, it feels like Phillips has got much better defensive instincts, particularly midfield, possibly because I guess Struyck has mainly played as a centre-back. He just seems to know when to engage with people and when to push forward and when to try and cut out the ball.
I think he does. He has the advantage of having done this now for 2.5 years. And certainly when I was comparing them, it was the one thing you had to be mindful of was that you were looking at coming up to now 3 years of evidence to base Phillips' performances on and only really a handful of games in defensive midfield for Struyck. So the comparison's a little bit difficult to draw, but certainly with the naked eye, I get the impression that Phillips is more mobile and like you say, perhaps a little better with his anticipation. I mean, if you look at the goal that Brighton scored, it was created initially by White breaking from his own half. And what happened in that instance was that Struyck was dragged up by the man marking system. He followed his man over halfway. Brighton played into the space behind him and White was able to sprint forward from there. But in a lot of ways, that was Rodrigo's fault. I'm pretty sure that White was Rodrigo's man, or at least Rodrigo should have been further back than he was. He was really on the edge of Brighton's box. And it was another instance, and we've touched on this previously this season, where Brighton were able to exploit the man-marking system because when you get it wrong, it does leave big gaps on the pitch. But I'm with you. I actually think, and I'm basing this mostly on the numbers, but also what I've seen of Struyck. I do think defensively he's good. And I do think defensively he probably has a lot of the right attributes for that position. But, as we've found with Phillips and as other professionals will tell you, it's a massively complicated and difficult role to play that because you're not only worrying about being the shield for Bielsa's centre-backs, you're also expected to kind of quarterback the game from there and to pass consistently, to have a good range of passes to open up the opposition. You've got to be good on both fronts. And, I think it underlines two things, really. It underlines how good Phillips is at it and how you should never kind of underestimate the difficulty of what he's been asked to do. But it's also reigniting the debate about whether, in order to find cover or competition for Phillips, do Leeds really need to think about getting into the transfer market with this? Can they develop Struyck quickly enough, or do they need to think that actually it would make sense to recruit because that, it's the more expensive way to do this, but it might actually get them something a bit more rounded and a bit closer to the player they're trying to replace. I'm a little bit in two minds about that, but I have to say, I think if push came to shove come the summer window, I would be looking to the market.
We've not seen a lot of them because of injuries, but do you think Cock or Llorente would potentially be second choice there if they were fit?
Well, Robin Koch can absolutely play in that position. Again, a little like Struyck, it's not his preferred position. He is a centre-back. And I think longer term, we'll find that Struyck will be a left-sided central defender. Bielsa did talk when Llorente came in about trying to make him adapt to that role as well, although I suspect he probably has further to go in learning that position than Koch. I get the impression that Koch is a bit more suited to that area. And that was one of the reasons why Leeds were very keen on him and went for him. It was not only his ability as a kind of ball-playing defender, but also his adaptability and his versatility, which pretty much has to apply to everybody, give or take, in Bielsa's squad. So I think so. I think that's the case. But again, you just feel that, like with Stroik, it's a little bit of experimentation. And it's not to say that Bielsa can't do that, because actually he's usually pretty or very successful on that front. But I suppose there are always going to come times where it doesn't work. And to a degree as well, there are always going to be positions where it's not actually easy for players to adapt. And I just wonder more and more whether the Phillips role, you know, that pivot position is one. You really need to know what you're doing there. And as I say, I think there is increasingly an argument to say that some cover in the transfer market might be the sensible option.
You picked out Ben White as your one to watch last week, Phil, and he had a great game and he did look really, really good. But just to return to something you kind of touched on there about the defensive midfield position, I think the defensive midfield position is a lot harder to play in Bielsa's side than it is in that Brighton side, because the defensive midfielder position is, as you said there, the fulcrum of Bielsa's team, you know, given how attacking we are. It's actually quite an isolated position as well. You can't really afford to make mistakes either in sort of tackling or distribution, whereas you contrast that with what Ben White was experiencing on Saturday. He had a lot more players around him, so if the ball spilled away from his feet, there's always somebody there next to him to pick it up, because Brighton were playing very sort of very deep on the edge of their area, and their tactic, as was quite profitable, as we mentioned there, about White running out with it, is to then carry it out into that big space in midfield.
That's very true, and whenever I write about Phillips, I try hard not to call him a holding midfielder, because I don't think he is a holding midfielder. He's in that zone, and defensively he's very important, but at best it's half of what he's being asked to do. And considering that Bielsa likes to play with possession, likes to dominate possession, likes to be the attacking team on the field, he is more often than not looking for Phillips to be on the ball and to be stretching play. I think if you looked closely at White, you saw that the breaks from deep were opportunistic for him, like with the goal. It was that scenario where the space suddenly opened up and it was an invitation to run into it. So he did. Whereas with Phillips, he's constantly looking, you know, he's constantly looking for those opportunities. He's constantly looking for the balls forward. He does play sideways a lot because, you know, Leeds build steadily and they take their time when they want to from the back. But equally, he will look for difficult balls out to the flanks and difficult balls through the middle when that option's on. So you're right, you're not just looking for a midfielder who can defend and a midfielder who's kind of got a naturally defensive brain, because remember that Phillips never had that initially. You know, he said to me when I asked him, I think of myself, or used to think of myself as box to box, you know, so he knew that he had to defend and he knew how to pitch in, but he would say that he never really understood the nuts and bolts of what you had to do in a position where a lot of the defensive duties fall on you. And it is so specialised that, yes, players can be converted to play there and it is possible, but not everybody's going to be up to it. It's not going to work with everybody. You're also in a division which is now, you know, considerably more unforgiving than the Championship was. So it just leaves the question mark, I think, over can Stroik do that longer term? Is he going to be suited to it and is he going to have all the attributes that he needs? And actually, for as long as, you know, Leeds don't have an obvious player to cover for Phillips, or an out-and-out defensive mid or holding mid in the form of a Phillips to cover for him, isn't that always going to be a problematic position?
Midfield as a whole feels to me like a bit of an issue at the minute when you're missing Phillips and Click's not quite on it at the minute, and we're not quite sure what to do with Rodrigo. You mentioned there about him not tracking his man, and we saw that Luke Ayling was dishing out a bit of a hammering to him at one point during the game against Brighton, asking him why he was there and why wasn't he tracking back. It doesn't feel like midfield is quite functioning right. Do you agree with that?
We weren't quite sure, actually, whether Ayling was shouting at him or shouting at the fourth official. My initial reaction was that he was bollocking Rodrigo. That was what I thought. But somebody else who was in the press box said, I think he was having a go at the fourth official at that point. So I'm not entirely sure. But I did mention during the game, I tweeted saying this, that I felt as if Rodrigo and Rafinha were almost a yard off when it came to their defensive jobs on Saturday. They seemed to be, in terms of applying the press and applying it effectively, they seemed to be giving Brighton too much space. They seemed to be too loose and not tight enough, and giving away that critical bit of room that means that a team can play through the man-marking system and can get beyond the press and cause trouble further up the field. I think it comes back to depth in the squad, really. It's the question of, if Matthijs Kleek isn't playing well, what do you do? Who do you replace him with? If Calvin Phillips isn't available, you can experiment a little with Struyck or Robin Koch, or, you know, potentially Stuart Dallas in there. Or, as has happened a couple of times this season, Matthijs Kleek can drop deep to play there. But then, of course, you leave that number eight role vacant, and minus somebody like Adam Foster, who, you know, still isn't fit, and I still couldn't even guess when, if ever, he's going to be back this season. There is a shortage of choice there, that I think. And we saw in the summer that they came very, very close to signing Michael Cuisance from Bayern Munich. I mean, that was basically done before the medical threw up issues and Leeds backed out. So that tells you that they did want something else in the centre of midfield. I think what Leeds have got to the point of doing now is not jumping on something because another deal's gone wrong. You know, I think that the feeling was, look, that hasn't happened. It's not the end of the world. We've got money we can put towards Rafinha instead for now, and we can revisit it. And I'm certain that they will do at the end of this season. But I'm with you. I wrote about this today, actually, about the low XG, and looked at, you know, what went on with Rodrigo, what went on with Struyck, the kind of lack of, not verbal communication, but football and communication between that midfield three against Brighton. It did feel a bit flat, and it did feel a bit out of tune. But then again, it wouldn't surprise you at all if at Newcastle next Tuesday it all clicks again on a much better pitch and with Phillips back. I think this is the thing. It was always going to be up and down this season, and that was a definite dip.
Let's have a word about the pitch then. You mentioned it there. You mentioned it at the start of the show. How much is that affecting us at the minute? Because as was rightly pointed out at the weekend, it was the same pitch for Brighton and they seemed to cope with it okay.
They did seem to cope with it okay, but I do think there's a difference between a side coming to Elland Road, a little bit like West Ham, for example, who are trying to pick off goals here and there. And if they do manage to score, we'll take what they've got and, you know, be disciplined in defending it, which is essentially what Brighton did in the main. I think Brighton were able to be a bit more positive on the basis that it wasn't working for Leeds and there was no real threat coming at them. But there's no doubt at all, and I wouldn't use it as an excuse, but I do think it has to be part of the explanation for what's going on. And we asked Bielsa afterwards about it, and he just said, look, I do not want to be drawn into pretending that the pitch is the reason that we played poorly. But his football is entirely reliant on tempo and pace. I remember speaking to one of the ground staff during the COVID lockdown, and they said, you know, the instruction from him is always short, fast and wet. You know, that's how the pitch in the grass at Elland Road has to be, and the same at Thorpe Arch, because it lends itself to the quick interplay and, you know, the constant attacking ball on the ground that Leeds like to do. So at the moment, it just isn't like that. And it must be slowing the tempo of the game. It must be taking a little bit more out of the players' legs. I don't think it totally explains some of the bizarre passing on Saturday, the simple balls that were going wrong. It just seemed to be all out of sync at the weekend. But it is a mess, and nobody at the club is denying that it's a mess. It's very, very old. There are fundamental issues with it that cannot be addressed or completely fixed without replacing the whole thing. And when I say replace the whole thing, I don't mean just taking the turf or the top layer off. I mean properly digging down and removing the old drainage, fitting new drainage, and essentially coming up with an entirely new structure. That will happen as it stands. That's due to happen next summer. But clearly there are a lot of games in between. And you know, in the meantime, it is a concern.
Thankfully, it's been a beautifully dry week since then.
if you do live outside West Yorkshire, it has been tipping it down nonstop for about, what, 5 days now?
Something like that, yeah.
Well, this is the thing, you see. And I got in touch this week with the club's old groundsman, a guy called Norman Southernwood, who people will probably remember. He spent years working as head groundsman at Leeds. And I was asking him about the pitch, and he said that even back in the 90s when it was fitted, there was an issue with the fact that the gravel layer deep down had developed this almost like what felt like a plastic film. It was natural, but it was like a plastic film that had covered areas of the gravel. And what it meant was that there were areas of the pitch which, when it rained heavily or when it snowed, simply wouldn't drain properly. So particularly by the tunnel, you know, by the west stand, that, and you'll always notice when you go in and the rain's been particularly heavy pre-match, that tends to be one of the areas which is covered with white sheets, because there obviously is a specific issue there. But you're right. I mean, the weather's been absolutely grim, and it's doing nothing to help at all. And the pitch is cutting up badly. I mean, from what I understand, the club are looking at, you know, short-term fixes and see if there's anything they can do, you know, just as a temporary solution to make the surface better for the games that are left. But in terms of a complete overhaul, it will have to be done in between seasons.
This is a very basic question. I don't know if it's been asked of anyone, but why is it left so long? Because it feels like they could still cut it a good couple of centimetres shorter than it was.
I don't know, actually. And I would be very surprised if it's longer than Bielsa wants it to be. I'm not sure whether, because it's so spongy and because it's cutting up so much, I'm not sure whether it looks longer than it actually is, if you understand me, because it's becoming so uneven. But as I say, Bielsa, like a lot of coaches, will have pretty strict specifications for what he expects of the grass. So I would assume that it's at the right length for him. I don't think that'll be the problem. I think the problem will just be that the actual turf itself and the drainage and the effect of the water lingering in the soil is just cutting it to pieces. And it's, you know, the pitch as it is at the moment is never going to get any better.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's kazoo concert in Kansas City, go Kevin, or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Well, had we faced Southampton as we should have done through this week, then we would have completed half a season. We're at the halfway point. Let's do a half-term report and let's look to grade Leeds United then in about 15 or 20 minutes' time. First of all, let's have a little dive through the first half of the season then, Phil. Played 18, won 7, drawn 2, lost 9 with a goal difference of minus 4 based on 30 goals scored and 34 conceded. Mixed form at the minute, but overall, what do you reckon to it? How has it been?
That seems to be describing a mid-table team, which is what Leeds are at the moment. I promise I'm not going to labour XG much more, but the goals scored and the goals conceded are pretty much bang on the money in comparison to the analysis. And I think a team who score as many as Leeds do and concede as many as Leeds do are unlikely to draw many games, which they haven't. They've got 2 out of 18 at the moment. And they've managed to trade off the defeats with wins and some very good wins at that. And I think whenever you're trying to weigh up how it's going for them, you always find yourself looking at the teams who came up with them last season and also to an extent the teams who've come up in previous years. And you can see Sheffield United a mile adrift at the bottom. You can see Fulham and West Brom finishing the bottom three as it stands at the moment as well. And I think all in all, it's been a really good and really positive season so far. I always feel that some analysis of it has been skewed by the fact that this almost like outlandish expectation of Bielsa and his team. I know he has this reputation for being a very special coach and quite a seminal coach in his ideas about how you should play the game. And a lot of elite coaches have been influenced by him and talk highly of him. But he is still a coach coming up with a championship squad and a championship squad that didn't change a huge deal. You know, there was a lot of money invested in the summer, but it was predominantly in four players, one of whom, Llorente, has been injured for, you know, for most of the season. And granted, they took on Mellier permanently and they extended Harrison's loan, but they were players who'd already been in the team and were already here. And I just feel that they're where they should be at the moment. And they need, you know, second half of the season, they've got to finish this off and they've got to make sure that they're safe and they stay up. And I think from this position, they need to do that comfortably to make sure that a season that I think has been more than passable so far doesn't become a bit dicey towards the end. But you can pick fault with aspects of the way they're playing or aspects of the team, like the defensive record and their shape at the back. But I think if you're being objective about a team who came up in July, they've been excellent, haven't they?
Are you aware of Project 538, which is one of those statistical analysis sites? They famously, and this is the caveat, they famously predicted that Hillary Clinton would beat Donald Trump 4 years ago in the American election. But it was a really useful metric last year following them and their probabilities of Leeds getting promoted and winning the championship and so on and so forth. Right now, they've got us at a 97% probability of staying in the Premier League based on their statistical analysis.
I must say I'm not a fan of supercomputers, which is what that sounds like. I'm not hugely familiar with the website, although I have heard of it. But the thing about supercomputers is that if they were any good, they'd be able to tell you before a ball was kicked where everybody was going to finish and how many points they were going to get. What I tend to find with supercomputers is that in previous seasons, certainly, when Hull suddenly went on a run of 5-6 games without a win, supercomputers started to say that they might go down. And you thought, well, yeah, I mean, that's kind of the way that the wind's blowing. But it makes sense. Michael and I were chatting off air and we were saying that, you know, in order for Sheffield United to catch Leeds, that they're going to have to, as it stands at the moment, they're going to have to win another 6 games to cut that gap. You know, West Brom and Fulham, 2 wins each from 19 or 18 games respectively. So, you know, a mile off the pace of what you need to stay in the division. And I think it's certainly the case that Leeds need to get themselves up over 30 points and up over 35 points, I would imagine. But I think even looking at Fulham and West Brom, it's still going to be a challenge for them to get to 30 points because they're a long way off the pace at the moment. And, you know, as it stands, West Brom after 19 games, if their form in the first half of the season is reflected by the form in the second, then they're going to finish on 22 points or something around about there, which is fewer than Leeds have got at the moment. So the odds and the chances are extremely high, it has to be said. And I always felt in the opening weeks that was the important aspect of the form, irrespective of them being on the cusp of the top 6 or within reach of the top 2 or 3 or whatever else. It was the gap to the bottom that mattered because they've got to stay up this season, you know, with it being a COVID year and finance being so tight and also having taken so long to get promoted. That was absolutely imperative. And, you know, the first half of the season has given them every chance.
I think I'm struggling to adapt after 2 seasons of chasing promotion to the idea that we can lose games and it's all right because everyone around us loses as well. Where I think we've come from a couple of seasons where we had to win every game because otherwise Norwich would win every week and Sheffield United and Fulham and West Brom and Brentford, all these teams that were chasing us down. Whereas now we lose a game and then it gets to the weekend and Fulham and West Brom and Fulham all lose and Newcastle lose and Palace lose. And actually nothing much changes that week, even though it feels bad because we've had a defeat.
Well, I suppose to put that another way, if Leeds were realistically safe by the middle of March and then went to Brighton and lost at the beginning of May, what are people going to fight about? You know, what is there to argue over? What is there to kill each other over? I mean, I guess by that point you can start looking ahead to the summer window and you know, to debate what it is about Leeds that needs and the team or Bielsa that needs to change in order for them to improve again. But if, you know, if they do stay up and if it isn't a scramble at the end, if it isn't a near-cut thing, then there is going to be a period of the season in which the results don't especially matter beyond the fact that you don't want your team to get beaten on any given weekend. And it has been a really sizable change from what we were used to in the EFL, where there was always something to go at. You know, there was always something to go at and there was always something that was highly unlikely to be secured, you know, in anything other than the dying embers of the season. Even last season, Leeds winning the title and cantering sort of 9-10 points clear in the end. It was only sewn up on the last Friday. You know, it was only the Friday night before the season finished that it was done and dusted and that promotion was confirmed. Whereas this time round, there is the scope for Leeds to be up and safe much earlier than that stage, which leaves you with a few dead rubbers from Leeds' point of view. I mean, don't get me wrong, there is going to come that run in April where they play City, Liverpool and Man United back-to-back. So they could have a really key influence on the title race. But in terms of Leeds' own ambition, I think they'd be quite happy if they could roll through, you know, the last 3, 4, 5 weeks of the season with nothing too much riding on it.
The idea of some dead rubbers does appeal, I have to say. I know generally it's used as a bad thing, isn't it? But the idea of just being able to see out the last month or two of the season, just thinking, well, win some, lose some, absolutely fine.
It's kind of, you know, you're looking in the week where America's elected a new president and it's, you know, politics is kind of on everyone's, at the forefront of everyone's mind at the minute. And how Leeds has been as a club to support in recent years, you're right, Michael, it's we've been dialed up so high, like politics has just been so polarised and everything's been riding on everything and everyone's so angry and tensions and anxieties are so high. But actually, we're just readjusting to the idea that mediocrity is, at least for now, fine for a bit.
We've got a weird way of achieving mediocrity, though, because we're doing it with these ridiculous swings of losing 6-2 and winning 5-0 and winning 5-2 and getting beaten at home by Brighton. And it feels like there's... I think that's the the massive fluctuations are probably where we get the sort of overly critical eye that Phil was talking about there, that we seem to be held to very high standards. I think because at points we have hit those heights, but underlying it is probably still quite a mediocre squad.
That was probably seen in the reaction to the Brighton defeat. And without pretending that it was a good performance, I think all of us, and probably me included to some extent, are in the habit of seeing poor results in a much more serious and consequential light than they actually are in now. And again, you can't ever be complacent, and you certainly can't assume that on 23 points, Leeds are going to stay up. I personally think they will, and I think they will be okay. But it's the fact that you said at the very start of this, Dan, 3 or 4 days on, that the heat's gone out of it, the sting's gone out of it. And because of that, when you look back, it doesn't feel like the consequences were huge. You know, the consequences become bigger if this spills into 4, 5, 6 games without a win. But that hasn't happened so far, and it hasn't really looked like happening so far either. And it is a change of mindset. I think it's something that people have to acclimatise to, really. Going from every result being absolutely critical, particularly when you're going for automatic promotion, because the margins in a good year in the Championship become so thin and so tight. Whereas now it's back to that thing about the intangible target. Yes, you want to stay up, but I don't think people are seeing, you know, that people can see the merit of finishing 17th and that you don't go down. But I think everybody would like the finishing position to be more convincing and more, you know, more encouraging than that. But it still leaves that wide open space and that debate about what is a good finishing position, what is a poor finishing position? Because really, is there any difference significantly between 9th and 14th? I don't really feel like there is.
Apart from millions of pounds.
There is
prize
that,
money,
yes. No, and actually, in this year of all years, you shouldn't disregard that.
Let's talk then about the first half of the season, because I guess all that will be brought to bear in the second half. What have been the positives and the not-so-positives? I don't want to call them negatives, because we don't want to be negative. We want to remain positive about this season, because it's been a good one so far, hasn't it? So the good things, off the top of my head, I can think how well we've adjusted to life, broadly speaking, in the Premier League, as reflected in the mid-table position at the minute. More specifically, let's start with Patrick Bamford, who has been a real boon this season.
Symptomatic, I think, of what you said there, which is how good the transition has been from the Championship to the Premier League. One of the things that I've been most pleased about is the way that they've managed to go from one competition to the other without significantly changing their style, without gutting the squad, without players who were very good in the Championship looking out of their depth in the Premier League. I think it's been peaks and troughs for a few of them, which was always going to be the case. But when they've been good, they've been very good, and they've been every bit as good as they were in the Championship. I'd probably pick out Everton away as the best of the performances, closely followed by Villa away and also Arsenal. I mean, I think Arsenal played into Leeds' hands by being very negative with their system and by really taking so few chances that it was Leeds' game to dominate. But, you know, those are some very good sides. Villa are looking much stronger this season than they did, and much more organised and much more complete than they did in the first year in the Premier League. And Everton have bags of potential, particularly, and talent, particularly up front. So I think, essentially, it does feel like they've got a foothold, Leeds, and it felt like they got a foothold early on. You know, once we got through the game at Bramall Lane and once Bamford nicked that late on, you felt like the impetus was there, and you felt like there was enough momentum to start making sure that results ticked over fairly regularly. And I think deep down, in spite of what happened at the weekend, I think Bielsa will be pretty happy with where they are and pretty happy with this period of adaptation, because they've coped with it well.
Just on Villa, I mean, I've got no axe to grind with Villa as a club. I think they're a good club. They should be in the Premier League. Maybe just because our paths have kind of been roughly in parallel for a few years. We seem to have developed, maybe it's Gabby Agbonlahor, or I don't know, some sort of daft rivalry with them. I have to say, I very much enjoyed seeing Dean Smith's disappointed face. You know, the offside goal, was it Rodri who came back onside?
Rodri, yes.
Yeah. I didn't necessarily enjoy that too much. I thought that's a shame. That the kind of, you know, VAR is ruining the game, blah, 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 blah. But seeing, you know, Dean Smith with a face like a bulldog chewing a wasp after that was great fun.
There's been a bit of niggle there. It has developed, although I don't see it becoming anything other than a sort of passing fad, this kind of false rivalry with Villa. I think to give them their due, their recruitment in the summer, a bit like Leeds, they seem to get it right and they seem to put the money in the right areas and gamble in the right places. And, you know, they again look like they're going to stay up without anything like the skinny of teeth act that was coming at the end of last season. But that was a really, really resounding victory, that at Villa Park. And obviously, Bamford took the headlines with his hat-trick, but all over the pitch, Leeds just had huge amounts of control and competence and confidence in the play. And it's been those performances that have been so encouraging. I always anticipated that they would lose heavily from time to time. I always anticipated that some teams would have the beating of them, you know, your Spurs, your Manchester United, Leicester as well. I'm not sure there's a team at the moment, at the exception of Leeds, that I like more in the Premier League than Leicester. It's not a wildly expensive squad. It's not the famous faces of world football squad, but it just seems wonderfully balanced. And they've got a hell of a lot of talent. They've got great player in Vardy and Madison. I quite often look at the talk about Jack Grealish and his potential and what he could become. I think Madison's got more ability than Grealish. I honestly think as an all-round player, there's more to like about Madison than there is about Grealish. But, you know, that was always a game that could get messy, and it did in the end. And likewise, Old Trafford away and Liverpool on the first day of the season, a lot of goals and that. But it's just been good to watch and it's been entertaining. But I think more to the point, it doesn't feel as if Leeds are just in the league to thrill people for a little bit before disappearing out of it again and fading back into obscure reaches of the EFL. I think there is a definite effort being made here to properly acclimatise and to adjust and to make sure that this becomes a kind of permanent residency for them.
I think that's why the Villa game felt nice, because we'd had the good performances against Liverpool and Man City, but obviously came out of it with a point, which is not ultimately going to be enough at the end of the season if you play nicely and only get one point in every two games. But Villa, it felt like the first time we'd really shown up and shown everything we could do and get the result to match it.
Very much so. And I think likewise Everton as well. And obviously they didn't score against Arsenal, but you know, it was like the post, it was the bar, it was Leno with that save from Dallas. Arsenal were very lucky to get out of that with anything. And I felt that before Pepe was sent off. That changed the game in the sense that it was all Leeds from that point forward, with the exception of the save from Melier towards the end. But, Leeds had that game on a string anyway, prior to that red card. But Everton, I never felt that Everton would stick around at the top of the league. I always felt that they're in sixth at the moment, and I still think that's probably a fairly realistic position for them, despite James Rodriguez coming in and Allen and the money that they've tried to throw at it. But they're a very good team with an extremely talented and proven manager. And I think to have gone there and not only won, but to have won deservedly, creating so many chances as Leeds did, that was a big, big feather in their cap.
Just looking at the games, when it comes to best games, I have shortlisted sort of Villa away, Everton away, Newcastle home and West Brom away as my favourite games. And I think it's because they all sort of roughly kind of benchmark where we are. If you exclude the top clubs that are going for the Champions League places, you look at Everton at the upper reaches of that, and then Newcastle as a side that's been fairly well established in the last few years but was recently promoted. Villa that were promoted a couple of years ago, West Brom that were promoted with us, they all give us a better sense of where we are in terms of our own progress. Have you got a favourite game, Michael?
Probably the Villa one, although I think the win against West Brom was satisfying in its own way for showing how far we'd come in a year versus them, and also for the fact that they brought Allardyce in, and it just felt like it was going to be, if we'd lost that game, it would have very much been pitched as, what was Bielsa doing? Look at these good old-fashioned British managers getting the job done. And I think I was delighted for me and for everyone who would have had to listen to that argument going on, that we just completely put it to bed and just destroyed them.
What about worst games then? I mean, Crawley in the FA Cup obviously is an obviously low watermark, if that's the right phrase I'm looking for. But if you exclude that as just a one-off aberration and deal with the Premier League, we've had a few sort of narrow defeats. Where would you put your sort of worst game this season?
I mean, the Man United game was incredibly hard to watch, because that was the one where you were watching it peeking through your fingers thinking they're going to score again here. Every time they attacked, they looked like they might score. We were so open right to the end, and it was, I think we got some praise for it afterwards because it was so entertaining, which it was, but God, I wish it had stopped. I was quite happy. I wanted that game to be over after the first 3 minutes or whatever it was that they scored in, because I just thought this has completely got away from us here. It just needs to be over. In terms of the more disappointing ones, because I consider them to be against teams that we could beat, games like Brighton and West Ham,
yeah,
they were the ones where I kind of left feeling we'd not given a good account of ourselves, and there was more that we could have done in those games.
Brighton, I think, is the worst performance of the season so far, I guess if you exclude Crawley. But the problem with the Crawley game is that between the changes and everything else, you're not really comparing like with like. I mean, Leeds should not have got trounced down there, but I think it's easier just to look at the league form in its entirety. The only team I feel who've completely schooled Leeds were Chelsea. I did feel that down at Stamford Bridge, they really had the measure of the way that Leeds pressed. They had the measure of how to play through it, and also were very, very good with Kante in there at dominating the midfield and stopping Phillips having that influence that he can exert at his best. And, you know, the scoreline looked worse at Old Trafford, but that was a kind of punch-for-punch game where Leeds were caught cold to begin with, but actually could have scored six or seven times themselves. It, like Michael says, it was so open. I mean, somebody asked Solskjaer after that game, one of the other journalists, quite seriously, are you disappointed that you didn't hit double figures? And, you know, it was that kind of evening where nobody seemed to be remotely worrying about trying to stop goals going in. They were just trying to score as many as they could at the other end. Whereas I think with Chelsea, it was far more measured. And at the start of the season, I had no real expectation of Chelsea competing for the title. I thought they'd be much closer than they are at the moment, but I didn't think they'd be in the mix ultimately. And when you saw that game and saw how well they played and how well they controlled it, you were inclined to think, do you know what, they might just have a chance here. But I mean, it's gone horribly wrong for them, and you know they've dipped badly since that, and I think that will probably go down at the moment as the peak of their season. I mean, sad that really. But Brighton, I think on Saturday, there was nothing good to say about the Brighton game. There was nothing in it for Leeds. There was nothing unlucky about it. There was nothing unjust. It was just horribly flat and horribly off colour by Leeds' usual standards. But again, that hasn't really been the story of the season so far. It's happened from time to time, but not consistently.
One more question then before we grade this first half of the season, each of us, and that is, do you think Bielsa will be happy overall with the first half of the season?
Not entirely, just because of the way he is. But I think overall he will realise he's going to achieve, he's well on the way to achieving his minimum goal, which is staying up. But I don't think he'll be happy, because I think he'll look back at games like Brighton and say we should have won that.
Yeah, the perfectionist in him will look at the you know, the ways in which it's gone wrong from time to time, the ways in which it could improve. But I think if push came to shove, he'd have to say that there's not an awful lot he can criticise about these 18 games so far. In isolation, there've been bad periods and there've been points at which Leeds haven't played well. But all in all, and say this again for, you know, a newly promoted club, it's been pretty much on the money.
All right, then let's grade it. For my part, I will go for a good solid B, I think, so far for this season.
I think so as well. I feel like we've got a bit of a tendency to want to downgrade it because the Brighton game is fresh in the memory. But if the games were to come in a different order and we'd just beaten Newcastle 5-2, we'd definitely be saying a B. So it's only fair.
I think that's fair. I thought we were going to do it out of 10, so I was going to give it a 7, which I think falls into the B category. I mean, just quickly as well, why don't we grade the four signings of the summer? Rodrigo, Rafinha, Koch and Llorente. What do we think about that? What's your perception of them?
I think Rodrigo, we haven't quite figured out where he fits yet in the jigsaw, and I think he will probably need a bit more time to fit into Bielsa's system. You know, the number of players we've seen who've required a bit of time or a season before it fully clicks, we've seen it with quite a few of them, haven't we? So I think he's the only disappointment, is probably overstating it a little bit. I probably only use that word because of the price that we've paid for him. I think there's a lot more to come from him, and we've seen flashes of complete brilliance, and he's got great vision and great ability, but maybe he just needs a bit more time to get where we want him to. I think it's probably too early to judge Llorente because of the injuries. Similarly, almost with Koch, who's looked good on his good days. Rafinha, I think, has probably been the one that stands out for me.
Yeah, Rafinha's the best one, I would say, so far. While Koch did show a lot of promise, we've not seen him for quite a while now, and I think we have seen enough of Rafinha to know that he's got a bit of magic about him, which is what we've liked, arguably, since Saez left. I think maybe someone who can turn a game. I know Pablo has been asked to do it, but he's not getting any younger, is he? So I think he'd probably the one we'd like the most, which is odd given he seems like he was probably the most frivolous of the signings, because I don't think we actually needed a winger. I think, as you say, we were in for Cuisance the week before and it felt like that was probably what we needed, but it was a bit like on a home shopping supermarket trip where they give you a replacement and you go, okay, that's completely different than the thing I ordered, but I'm willing to give it a go. It seems pretty good. And I think overall, I can't imagine the team without him now. He feels like one of the first names on the team sheet.
Yeah, I can't disagree with a lot of that. I said to somebody on Twitter earlier this week, because they were asking, what do you make of the signings? And I said, I think Rodrigo looked class on his day, but you know, can kind of drift out on others. Rafinha, the best of them so far, I would say. Koch, when he's been good, he's been very good and very impressive. And like you said, Dan, Llorente, it's impossible to say at the moment. And I kind of came around to the conclusion that I still do feel that Leeds have signed four very, very good players there. But we're just kind of waiting to see exactly how they're all going to drop in and exactly when it's going to click for them. It hasn't quite clicked perfectly, I don't think, but I think it could.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
Let's do it later.
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Well, no game at the weekend. However, we do have Newcastle United midweek after that. They're in really, really poor form at the minute, not looking good at all. You know, Steve Bruce has been under the cosh basically from the start of this season. It doesn't look to be getting any better for him.
No, he's been under the cosh since he was appointed, because there was, seemed to me anyway, there was a pretty large section of the fan base at Newcastle who didn't want him there, weren't keen on the appointment, felt like it was an Ashley appointment, if you want to give that some air quotes, and probably quite symptomatic of a club who are drifting without a huge amount of spark or panache or ambition. So it's never been good for him there. It's never been great. He's had periods where the results have been decent and people have been inclined to lay off. But I think it was inevitable that this sort of period was always going to come round again. And it does feel as if whenever it goes wrong for Bruce, that there is a crowd there waiting to pile in. I mean, I don't think he can object to an awful lot of the criticism. They, you know, since coming to Elland Road, they haven't picked up a win in that period, and that's running back to the middle of December now. And it is having an effect on the league position. And I think one of the most damaging things for Bruce, certainly recently, has been the game at Sheffield United. And it's not because of the result down there. Sheffield United were always bound to win at some stage eventually. But you know, I was listening to the Five Live commentary beforehand, before I sat and watched the game, and they were saying on there, it feels like a negative lineup from Newcastle. It feels as if Bruce is going there and being less ambitious or less attacking than he should be against a side who up until that point hadn't been able to buy a win. And, you know, Bruce said afterwards, I got it wrong. We were terrible. You know, we were abysmal. We didn't play well enough. You know, I have to take a lot of the blame for that. But I don't think that's going to wash, because it doesn't look to people, you know, looking at him from the outside and seeing what he's doing, it did look as if he wasn't brave enough in that game. You know, even against a side who had 2 points against the bottom of two points at the bottom of the division, he wasn't brave enough to go there and to ask Sheffield United to play Newcastle's game rather than Newcastle go there and let Sheffield United play theirs. And I think it's going to be, I was going to say, a long way back from that result. I'm honestly not sure Bruce will recover from any of this. I think it's inevitable that this descent around him will continue and will be there until he goes. But it will be a case of when Ashley decides to do that. And you know, we touched on what was going on at Newcastle before the game at Elland Road, December the 16th. And it just feels there that, yes, the squad isn't brilliant. Yes, the manager probably isn't what the supporters are looking for up there. But again, and you know, this was the case at Leeds for many years, the problem seems to be at the top.
Yeah, I was just about to say, actually, they remind me a lot of a Premier League version of Leeds under Bates, like completely lacking any ambition to be a good football team. And it all just feels a bit hopeless. I mean, I've said before, like my next-door neighbour but one is a Newcastle fan, and he's just like, well, this is what we are now. You know, there's no effort to be good.
I mean, they have spent some money, though, haven't they? I think that's the thing with them, that it's almost the direction they've spent it in. Where they've chucked money at stuff, it feels careless and frivolous. It doesn't feel like they've identified players to fit a style or anything. It is just a case of, here's some footballers.
Yeah, we better buy somebody to stop the fans moaning.
Exactly. And it feels like with Bruce, I mean, the fans have been moaning about Bruce, to their credit, all season, even at the start, where they were actually winning games. They were saying, this is dreadful. it'll get worse. It's not, we can't sustain results playing like this because we're terrible. And sure enough, in the last month, that is exactly what's happened. And they've now they can't even beat Sheffield United. I think they've got like 2 points in that run. They've lost to Brentford in the cup. It's just, it feels like all of the negativity that was there has completely fallen on top of them now. And there's not even an odd win thrown in there to try and dig them out of it.
Yeah, and we've had a bit of a wobble recently. Would you agree, Phil, that this is probably, I don't even want to say it out loud, but it's almost the ideal fixture? If you could pick one, a team that's really, really low on confidence, fans are disgruntled, they don't look like doing anything. If you could pick a fixture right now, it'd probably be against Newcastle, wouldn't it?
I think a neutral person would say that. There's a bit of danger involved in this, though, in that I think the next team to lose to Newcastle are going to seriously get it in the neck from their own support. And the way that Newcastle did down at Sheffield United, you know, even though Sheffield United looked considerably better than them on the night, you were still talking about the worst team in the Premier League turning over Newcastle. And I think as it stands at the moment, there would be a lot of people who would be classing Newcastle as the current worst side in the Premier League. So you are looking for Leeds to go there and play well, and you are looking for Leeds to go there and beat them. And I think a little like Brighton, but again, it's not, you know, it's not urgent, this. It's just a game that you don't want to lose. You know, it's a game that Leeds could do without losing, because the potential for the table to close up a little bit more, it does kind of spread a little bit more bad feeling, because like you say, that there isn't a huge amount going on in Newcastle. You mentioned, you know, that Leeds under Bates, and I think that's a really good comparison, in the sense that there are a lot of periods in that where Leeds want a shambles. You know, they want a shambles. They just weren't doing anything, and they didn't look like doing anything. So hopeless, that was the word you used. I mean, I almost feel like pointless, really. I don't, at the moment, I don't understand what the point of Newcastle is. They don't seem to be fishing for anything other than survival in the Premier League. But in this scenario, they should be pretty comfortably off to particularly with what's at the bottom of the division. It shouldn't be difficult for them this season. They've got a decent striker in Callum Wilson. I think they have got players. I mean, I have no idea what the deal is with Joe Linton. I just don't know what he's supposed to be. And I don't know how it is that they've ended up paying £40 million for him. I'm just baffled by him every time I watch him play. But I think there is enough there to stay up and to do it without scraping it. But even in that scenario, Ashley doesn't seem to have any outlook beyond any of that. You know, there doesn't seem to be any intention or particular interest in winning trophies. I don't mean he wouldn't be happy if they did, but it doesn't seem to bother him either way. And it does. They're in that pointless zone that Leeds were in when they kept, you know, under Bates, it wasn't quite happening, or it was drifting. And then latterly, when they kept finishing 15th in the Championship, what is the point in any of this? And where is it all going? And that seems to be very much the mood up north.
Stay up, don't lose money, and sell the club.
Yeah,
I think he's more or less what Ashley's plan is at the moment.
I'll tell you what Joe Linton is. He's the guy who will score the winner on Tuesday, now you've said that, honestly. What you were saying there, Phil, actually,
well, yes,
quite interesting about the next team that loses to Newcastle will get it in the neck. That strikes me as more of a fan anxiety than a legitimate concern from a football point of view, that I think Bielsa's team and squad are probably a little bit more mentally resilient than that. We've bounced back from these disappointments like Brighton before and been able to turn it on in subsequent games.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I wouldn't expect the squad or Bielsa to think in that way at all about Newcastle. I'm just envisaging Twitter in the aftermath of a 1-0 defeat at St James's Park. I was following the replies to Newcastle's tweets after the game at Bramall Lane, and it does make me think that all the available jobs in the world, I think club social media officer is probably the one I want least. You are on a hiding to nothing with that, and there's literally no way to manage it in a way that's going to be anything other than carnage. But I mean, I was joking with something, saying I was getting the impression that they do seem to be concerned about relegation. I can understand why, because it is setting in up there, and it's been a long time since they won a game. But there's more this tone of resignation. I was saying to somebody, it's like somebody waking up on a desert island after 4 years there and saying, oh, look, it's the same tree again. And just thoroughly sick of it all. You know, can't even bring themselves to try and dig out false positives in what's happening. And again, you know, it's not to, you shouldn't be blasé about this, because Leeds aren't far enough clear that they can, you know, they can feel comfortable or feel as if the season's totally in hand. But when you start to pick through sides further down the division, and you know the bottom three obviously, but then Burnley, where it all seems a bit fractious with Dyche and the board. And okay, they've had a takeover, so that may change. But Newcastle, where all's not well, and Wolves, where it's suddenly becoming pretty difficult for Nuno, they're in good shape of Leeds. And comparing the atmosphere here to the atmosphere elsewhere, it's a pretty healthy comparison.
To go back to the Bates comparison, I remember in those years of drifting, and largely under Chelino and everything in between as well, was the feeling that we might as well not bother. There were times when I thought, I wouldn't mind if we just started again. Just walk away from this version of it. Let's just start again in the conference. It might be a laugh. And at least it won't be this grinding year after year nonsense.
Yeah. It just makes me think, though, of season 3 in League One, where Leeds were getting beaten down at Gillingham, and you're driving home thinking, are we looking at a fourth season in this? And if we are, is anybody going to be able to take it? You know, I think Leighton Orient was fun once, but by the time you're coming around to it for a fourth time, the kind of fire had gone out a little bit. But I think those are almost the worst seasons, the seasons of nothingness, where you don't feel like you're going to go down, you don't feel like you're going to go up. It's easier to sell in the Premier League because the amount of income you get annually is so massive that mid-table is actually worthwhile in a financial sense. But in the Championship, it is just one massive drift. You know, 15th after 15th, there's nothing to it. There's nothing building. It's not leading anywhere. And you cannot pretend in any way that those seasons of mediocrity in the Championship built ultimately towards Leeds going up. What built towards Leeds going up was, first of all, Radrazzani coming in, but then secondly, the decision to appoint Bielsa, where everything seemed to change overnight. I mean, I don't not credit Radrazzani for this. You know, I think as chairman of the club, you've got to take the hits when it goes wrong, and you've got to take some of the credit when it goes right. But you cannot pretend that the season before Bielsa wasn't as much of a mess or as much of a sort of aberration as some that had gone before. You know, between Christensen and Heckenbottom, they were a mile off the pace. And it was just that inspired decision to go for Bielsa that was, in the end, like a click of the fingers. And everything changed almost overnight. Whereas those seasons of no hope, no ambition, nothing doing, it was just 12 wasted months every time. There was nothing to it. There was nothing to take from it. And it has shifted slightly up in the northeast because they are now starting to worry that they're going to get sucked in and get into serious trouble in the bottom three. But I think even if they were to win 3 or 4 games out of the next 6 or 7 and pull away again, you won't lose any of the general disillusionment about the fact that they just don't seem to have anything about them.
But it could be worse. They could be Sunderland.
That's very true, yes. And having worked up there for a number of years, I can say that very much reflects the mindset in Newcastle. So going back to the desert island analogy there, Phil, like the bloke waking up after 4 years, is Newcastle's only hope Wilson?
Well, it'll be interesting to see what Bruce does, because he has from time to time gone 4-4-2. He has played one up front. I felt when they signed Wilson, good player, really good finisher, I felt that he would probably be the difference between them going down and staying up, because I thought he would get enough goals. I thought that would prove to be a really good signing. And I was a little surprised that a few more clubs higher up the division weren't in for him, because he does have goals in his game without a doubt, but they don't really seem to be playing to anybody's strength at the moment. They just need to make sure that it doesn't become absolutely endemic. I mean, it's been a lengthy run without a win. The longer this goes on, the more they're going to close up. I actually thought Fulham, for a team third from bottom, played pretty well against Manchester United last night. I think West Brom beating Wolves tells you that from time to time they are going to pick up results under Allardyce. This is a good season to be in the Premier League, because I think points-wise it will probably be easier to stay up than most. But at the same time, that is not a scramble that you want to get sucked into at the bottom.
We kind of know how this game's going to go, don't we? You know, generally speaking, it's form, it's shape. We're going to see a probably deep-lying Newcastle side. We're going to see Leeds try and attack them. Will we see another 5-2?
Well, the thing about a deep-lying Newcastle side is that it didn't work for them that at Elland Road. And I know they were in the game. I know they scored first. I know it was 2-2 going late into the match. But they'd had very little of it. And it felt as if they were holding out and trying to hold out and hoping that they would hold out. And once Leeds went ahead for the third time, the spirit and the energy just seemed to go from Newcastle, and they were cut to shreds towards the end. So if they play deep and they lose again, it's almost a way of saying that Bruce doesn't seem to be learning from what has come before against Leeds. Although, granted, I understand that it is very tough to play any other way against Bielsa. If you are going to fight fire with fire, you have to hope that you're going to do what Manchester United did over at Old Trafford. But I'm not disagreeing with you. I think you're probably right. I think Leeds will try to dominate. I wouldn't be surprised if Newcastle, to an extent, are happy to let them dominate. And as you know, as I was saying a little earlier on this podcast, with Phillips back and a much better pitch at St James's, you would like to think that there'll just be a little bit more verve in Leeds' performance.
Phillips back in then. Do we see what Strike drop back into defence? Do we see Llorente come in, ailing to right back? It's a change I think I'd like to see.
It must be Llorente's time soon. With Cock injured, and we were expecting him to be out for 3 months, it put a little injury update on his social today, which you know is kind of indicating that it's all going well. But again, as is always the case, he'll need to come back and get match fit and probably play a couple of 23s games. Llorente, he cost £18 million. He's a Spain international. He's got a lot of La Liga experience. Given that that slot there is open if you push Luke Ayling back to his preferred position at right back, you would have to say and you would have to feel that the time is surely coming for Llorente to get a chance there and to get a run. I still think when all's said and done, Robin Koch will be Bielsa's first choice in that position. And given that, Llorente, you'll remember when we spoke to our Sociedad expert, he was saying that, you know, he is very, very right-footed. Llorente, he does lean heavily towards that side. And Bielsa likes to have a left-footer on the left side of his centre-back pairing. So I still think you're looking at Koch and Liam Cooper being the first choice pairing there. But there is no point in Llorente being in the squad at an £80 million fee if he isn't going to feature. And he had a 23s game earlier this week. He's been back around the squad for a good fortnight, a good 3 weeks now. Maybe this will be his time.
Right, then let's have a one to watch, the player issue, battle, whatever it might be, that will be a key feature of the upcoming game. And let's have some predictions as well. So what are we going for this week?
Well, look for Phillips. I think look for the difference that Phillips makes coming into that team as opposed to what we saw against Brighton. And I know that's obvious and I know it's kind of easy pick, but I think this would be a good occasion to kind of look at the contrast between, you know, that performance against Brighton without him and the performance hopefully at Newcastle with him. Because, you know, you can pick out a game like Villa away, for example, when Phillips was injured and Cleek played in that defensive midfield role, and once Strike had gone off after the early booking, and they were, you know, as we said earlier, that was one of the best performances of the season. Cleek seemed to have that down to a T on that particular night. So it can be done without Phillips, but I think more often than not, he makes, you know, such a huge difference, and will hopefully do so when they go up to St James's Park. Just as an aside as well, keep an eye on Bruce, because if they do lose again and if this carries on going, I don't see that it can go on forever for him.
I think I successfully predicted a 1-0 defeat last week.
You did, yeah. You said donk, didn't you, with
the
goal? Yeah.
I did. I was thinking a set piece, which it wasn't, but, you know, still.
And it came earlier in the game rather than 88, which would have been the ultimate disappointment. But, you know, fair play.
I must admit, I didn't see the game panning out quite as it did. I thought we would dominate more than we did and they would kind of get the goal and the break from a set piece, which didn't turn out to be the case because they were just probably a bit better than us overall. Newcastle shouldn't be. It feels like Brighton had been generally playing all right and losing narrowly. It feels like Newcastle have more or less got what they deserved in the last few weeks. So please let's win.
No, you always look terrified when
I am always terrified.
Just make a prediction then.
We'll win.
He mumbles. Yeah, I agree. I think we're due a win. We're due a performance. So why not this one? I think it's an away win.
Yeah, I'm going with that as well. I have a sneaky feeling it could be by a decent margin as well, a little bit like the last game.
Fingers crossed. Right, we will reconvene next week to see if we were right. Well, we'll know on Tuesday whether we were right or not. And then we will just get to laugh at how wrong we were when we speak again. In the meantime, have a look at Phil's writings. The stuff with Romario Vieira is on there this week. Really, really good read. Discount now if you want to sign up for The Athletic, $3.99 a month. Read all Phil's stuff, all the stuff by the other journalists, and the stuff about sport from around the world. To sign up, go to theathletic.com/LeedsPod. And we'll speak to you next week. Bye-bye.
The Phil Hayes Show.